So instead of the regular Bhagavatam class this morning, we'll have a short session on Srila Prabhupada, the living Bhagavatam. Most of you, I think, probably aware of this seminar that I usually present when I talk. It's a look into Srila Prabhupada's practical application of Krishna consciousness. Of course, the philosophy's there. But seeing how Srila Prabhupada was living the philosophy, how he was applying it in different situations, in people's lives, of course that increases and deepens our understanding and makes it more relevant to us in our practical daily lives. So if nobody objects, I'll do a session. This morning I thought we could talk a bit about chanting, since that's the whole purpose of our Krishna consciousness movement. And in particular about just Srila Prabhupada's intention when he set off for the West, what he was focused on, what he was doing when he left India on the Jaladuta there. He actually, once he got everything lined up with his ticket and the dates and everything, Prabhupada, the day before he left, because he set sail for America on Friday the 13th of August. So just 2012, how many years is that now? 46 years? I think, yeah, 46, 65, sorry. Then the day before, Prabhupada went to Mayapur, to the Chaitanya mat there, to the samadhi of his spiritual master, and he spent several hours there praying and chanting to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati just to get his blessings for his mission. So in preparation for going, Prabhupada had a little leaflet that he printed up and what he intended to hand out to people as soon as he arrived in America. Because he wasn't going there as a tourist. He wasn't going just to check out America and see how people outside of India were living. Although he'd never been out of India before, Prabhupada's going to America was very specific. It was a very focused mission that he was on. He had been instructed by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati to preach in the English language. Although it didn't, you know, in that instruction you'll see he doesn't specifically say, I want you to go to America, you know, or other countries. But he said that you preach your... well, knowledgeable in this English language. The implication is that because it's an international language, you'll be able to reach a far wider audience than just here in India. And of course, we see how Prabhupada was always trying to preach in English, even in India, even when there was no, you know, hope or intimation that he would be able to leave India and preach in, you know, America and other places. But in 1944, he started up Back to Godhead magazine in the English language. That was published, it was printed at Saraswati Press, which Prabhupada said was the best printery in Calcutta. It was printed on the best paper available, and the first issue came out on the appearance day of his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And he managed to get two issues out that year, and then practically he was not able to do anything more till about 1950. And in the 1950s you can see how he was struggling, you know, to preach in the English language, try to get the message out to others. When he left home and he went to Jhansi and he started the League of Devotees, he was using the Back to Godhead magazine as his main instrument for his preaching endeavors. Just recently I was just reading a letter that he sent to the members of the League of Devotees, or at least the, you know, supporters that he contacted. Of course, the League of Devotees, it's a bit of a misnomer. I once asked Prabhupada, you know, exactly who is or was the League of Devotees. Because when we were in Vrindavan in October of 76, Akshaya, he was Prabhupada's door guard. He was traveling with the party. and he had gotten a hold of the original, one of the original prints of the first canto, part one. And there it mentions there that it was published by the League of Devotees. So I was kind of curious, you know, who is this League of Devotees? It's plural. So I asked Prabhupada, you know, was that you and some God brothers or, you know. So after a little bit of coaxing, I asked him three times to find out who it was. Finally, he just left. He said that was me. He said, I alone was doing everything. You know, I was on my own. But he said, I was trying to do something through that League of Devotees. Because the League of Devotees was kind of like the forerunner to ISKCON. But anyway, the point was that Prabhupada was struggling alone and trying, working very hard. Every now and then he would get enough money together to be able to publish his Back to Godhead magazine. So in dribs and drabs, a couple of copies in 1950, a couple of issues in 52. In 56 he managed, I think, to get about six issues out. The best year that he had at publishing Back to Godhead was in 1960, I think, when he did 11 or 12 issues. And then he stopped it because he wanted to work full-time on his Bhagavatam. But the point was that he had plans. He had big plans. He'd taken this instruction of his spiritual master to heart. And Prabhupada was a big thinker. He wasn't small, you know, in his scope, even though he was limited physically in what he could do. But in his desire, he was practically unlimited. I once interviewed Dr. Abhiyal Kapoor, Adi Keshavadas. He was one of Prabhupada's godbrothers. And they had become very close when they were living in Allahabad in the early 1930s. That time, Abhiyal Kapoor was a young student, philosophy student. He was about 19 years old. And he started coming to the Gaudiya Math temple. He said at the time, he said, I was a full-on Mayavadi. But then later on, by hearing Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati preach, and he even went on tour with him for a while, then he got converted into being a Vaishnav. So he would come to the Gaudiya Math temple in Allahabad, and he became good friends with Srila Prabhupada. Of course, Prabhupada at that time was fully into his pharmacy business and looking after his family. But he was an expert mridanga player, good kirtan leader. And so every evening, practically as often as he could, he would come to the temple there and he would lead the kirtans. So one day, Dr. Kapoor came. He was a bit sick, had some kind of flu or cough or something. So Prabhupada told him, I'll give you a tonic that will cure that disease, that fever. So he said, all right, thank you very much, I'll accept your tonic, but I want the one that you're taking. So then Prabhupada said, what is that? So he said, the one that gives you love of Godhead. So then Prabhupada left and he said, well, actually, he said, I don't have that tonic, but I know the formula. He said, and I will preach it all around the world. So that was like 1933, 34, sometime around that time. So Dr. Kapoor was telling me this late 80s, I think it was, when I spoke to him. So he said, at the time, I didn't think much of it, you know, all around the world. It didn't really register at all. But he said, now looking back, he said, I can see that even at that time, he was thinking about, you know, this worldwide preaching. And so in the mid-50s, 1956, I came across this letter that Prabhupada wrote to whoever, you know, was giving a little support to the League of Devotees. And it was a proposition that they sponsor the printing of Back to Godhead for distribution overseas. And what Prabhupada did was he listed about 50 different countries, just alphabetically. He went through all the different countries he could think of. And then he assigned a certain number of Back to Godheads to be sent to each country. I mean, who he was going to send them to, I have no idea. But he had a plan, you know, Afghanistan, 2,000 copies, America, 10,000 copies, you know, UK, 10,000 copies, France, Switzerland, this one, that one. It's about 50 different countries. And when you add up all the copies that he wanted to send out each month, it was something like 75,000 copies. And that, you know, this is at a time when he was barely struggling to get one issue out and, you know, sell a few copies of that in the tea stalls in Delhi. But this is what he was thinking. You know, 75,000 copies a month would go out all over the world, and somehow or another that would find its way into the hands of the intelligent class of man, and they would take up Krishna consciousness. So that was Prabhupada. He was a very broad, you know, ambitious person in Krishna's service. So similarly then, when he left left India to go to America then in 65, he took with him a small leaflet. And that leaflet tells us everything about Prabhupada's character and about, you know, what his intent was. So August the 4th, 1976, Prabhupada was in New Mayapur in France. And after having his afternoon nap, he got up, he came in and sat down, and somebody had put, maybe it was Yogeshwar, had put on his desk a copy of that original leaflet that he had taken with him in 1965. So Prabhupada was looking, he was a bit curious. So rather than take it up and look at it himself, he asked me to read it out to him. So Prabhupada's picture was on the front with the title reading, Srimad Bhagavatam, India's Message of Peace and Goodwill. 60 volumes of elaborate English version by Tridandi Goswami, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, carried by the Sindhya Steam Navigation Company Limited all over the world for scientific knowledge of God. So while Prabhupada relaxed behind his desk, I read out the body of the text. It says, the sufferings of the entire human society can at once be brought under control simply by individual practice of Bhakti Yoga, a simple and easy process of chanting the holy name of God. Every country, every nation, every community throughout the world has some conception of the holy name of God. And as such, either the Hindus or the Mohammedans or the Christians, everyone can easily chant the holy name of God in meditative mood. And that will bring about the required peace and goodwill in the present problematic human society. Any inquiry in this connection will be gladly answered by Sri Swamiji. The Hindus generally chant the holy name of God in the 16 chain of transcendental sound composed of 32 alphabets as Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The Vedic literatures like the Upanishads and Puranas recommend the chanting of the above-mentioned 16 holy names at a stretch, and Lord Sri Chaitanya, whose cult of chanting the holy name of God gave special importance on these transcendental sounds. In this age of Kali, or the age of hate, hypocrisy, corruption, and quarrel, the only remedial measure is that every man should chant the holy name of the Lord, both individually and collectively. Then it went on to give the English translations of the 8 prayers written by Lord Chaitanya in glorification of the holy name. And it ended with some highly complimentary reviews of Prabhupada's translation of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So we can unpack that little leaflet a little bit more and just, you know, analyze it a bit to see where Prabhupada was at. Just, you know, the beginning of it. He starts off, of course, by saying, Srimad Bhagavatam, India's message of peace and goodwill. So those two things, if you like, are the summary of what the world needs. It's far from peaceful, either individually or collectively. Everybody's always disturbed. And there's no goodwill. Everybody's in competition with everybody else. And everybody's, you know, trying to cheat, steal, and get an advantage over everybody else to further their own purposes. So peace and goodwill, you know, that's what Prabhupada's saying the Bhagavatam's all about. How to become peaceful and how to have goodwill towards all other living entities. So he says 60 volumes of elaborate English version. So at that time, you know, Prabhupada had just spent the last 4 years doing the first canto. He had stopped work on the BTG in 1960 and took up full-time work on the Bagwatam probably in late 1960-61 when he moved to the Rowdy Damodar Mandir. And that's practically all that he was doing. For the following few years, he was doing some preaching, but he told us he wasn't going out very much because he was busy with his writing. And don't forget that he had to do all this by hand. There was no computers in those days. Prabhupada was either handwriting it or he was banging it out on the typewriter. And he was doing everything himself. He was writing, he was editing. Then he had to get it all published. So by the time, at the end of 1962, he had the first canto, part one. Then in the end of 63, he had the first canto, part two. And then by the end of 64, he came out with the third volume, completing the first canto. So it took him at least 4 years of intense work, to come out with the first canto. And there are 12 cantos. Then he got the opportunity to go to the West. So then he wasn't, doing any writing for some time whilst he was traveling and when he got established in America. But here, he's immediately, as soon as he lands, he's going to give out this leaflet to anybody that he meets, saying that they can get 60 volumes of the Srimad Bhagavatam from him. He's 70 years old, so you can do the math. If it took him 4 years to do the first canto, and he's 70 years old, how old is he going to be by the time he completes the whole Srimad Bhagavatam? But Prabhupada was not thinking, what cannot be done. He was thinking what can be done. So, 60 volumes, he's immediately advertising. That's Srila Prabhupada. Very expansive, very ambitious, not at all thinking about any kind of limitation, but he had his sights set on a particular goal, and he was going to push for that. Then he says, carried by the Sindhya Navigation Company all over the world. He'd been given, a free passage to New York, and that also reluctantly by Samati Murarji, who thought that he might die on the trip over, or at least when he got to America, she was fearful, maybe he'll become destitute. He has no friends, he has no money, he has no support. What will he do when he gets to America? So he had to persuade her to let him go, on the Jaladuta. So he got one ticket to New York, but he's already advertising all over the world. Whether, he was trying to put some psychological pressure on Samati Murarji, that if I do something okay in New York, then you can carry me around, on your boats to other places in the world. But that was Prabhupada's ambition, that all over the world, from the 1930s, from the mid-1950s, Prabhupada was thinking, not in small terms. He was aiming for the entire planet. That was his purpose. And then for scientific knowledge of God. I was just reading, just the other day, I was looking through a few of Prabhupada's purports in the reprint of the original Bhagavatams. And Prabhupada uses that phrase several times, quite a few times, scientific knowledge of God. Very deliberate. Prabhupada wasn't just trying to kind of cash in, on the popularity of the scientific mentality. Because the idea of science, being true knowledge, science being everything, the scientists are worshipped, practically as gods. That all came in the last century, especially from, the 1910, 1920s onwards. So-called science started to become very prominent. But prominent as a competitor to religion. If you look at, Isaac Newton, he was a theist. You look at Einstein, he was a theist. But the atheistic science, that started coming in, when Darwin's theories got a hold in the early part of the 20th century. So by the time, Prabhupada came to America, especially, the 60s, that kind of evolutionary spirit, idea of evolution, chemical evolution, biological evolution, etc., was very, very prevalent. And in fact, in April of 1966, there was a Time magazine that came out. It had no picture on it. It had three words on the cover. It was a black cover, and in red letters it said, "Is God dead?" So, you know, that was the mood, that was the atmosphere that Prabhupada was coming into. But he was saying scientific knowledge of God. That was his mission. He was going to teach people scientific knowledge of God. So it was very deliberate. Prabhupada was challenging, you know, this idea of, you know, chemical evolution, atheism. He was coming right into the middle of it and challenging that I can give scientific knowledge of God. Whereas most ordinary people or most people think that you either have science or religion, but you can't have the two together. Science means knowledge and religion means sentiment. You know, all right, it might invoke some good, you know, emotions or whatever, so it might be useful from that point of view, but you can't have knowledge and religion in the same basket. You know, if you want knowledge, you got to go to science. If you want religion, you have to leave science behind. And here's Prabhupada coming into the middle of that and saying, no, the Bhagavatam is scientific knowledge of God. Therefore, we see with the Mayapur temple, Prabhupada planned to have, you know, a temple of the Vedic planetarium, science and religion together in the most important center of Krishna consciousness on the planet. Very deliberate. And taking, you know, the most, what was probably the most difficult portion of the Bhagavatam to understand, the fifth canto, cosmology, and present that up front in the, you know, a huge temple in Mayapur. Prabhupada was very deliberate in challenging, you know, this so-called scientific concepts. And he wanted to show that true understanding of God is scientific. It includes science, and it's there in the Bhagavatam if you understand it properly. So he's throwing down a gauntlet almost. He's handing out, you know, he's this little Swami from India that nobody's ever heard of, with no means, no friends, and he's handing out a pamphlet saying he's going to teach scientific knowledge of God. But he was confident that he could do it. That's the point. In December of 75, we were on a morning walk, and Alanath was there. And he had just, I think, come from Sweden. So he was telling Prabhupada that we're going to produce a magazine which will challenge, you know, the scientific concepts. So Prabhupada immediately cautioned him. He said, do not do this unless you are expert. He said, unless you know the arguments and you are confident that you can defeat them, then don't do it. Otherwise, he said, it will be a farce. Yeah, people will not take it seriously. He said, I can challenge them. He said, because I am confident that this soul cannot be manufactured by any material means. That was Prabhupada's basis for his preaching, that he knew that life comes from life. He was absolutely certain that you cannot produce life from a combination of chemicals, and he could therefore challenge and talk with anybody from any sphere of life. When you get to that point, nobody has anything to say. Even, you know, Richard Dawkins recently, he was on the TV with the Archbishop of Canterbury or somebody, right? Archbishop of Canterbury. And he had to himself admit, he said, actually, I can't say that I'm a complete atheist. So on a scale of 7, I'm a 6.9. But he said, I can't say for sure that God does not exist. So even he had to admit it. Because if you ask them, you know, where's your proof that life comes from chemical combinations, nobody can say anything. Nobody's ever done it. Nobody's ever done a single experiment which proves that life can come from a combination of chemicals. So Prabhupada was absolutely certain that you can never show that life comes from matter, but rather the opposite way around, that matter is generated by the influence of life, and that's what the Bhagavatam's all about. There's lots of cosmological descriptions there, and especially in the fifth canto, it describes a lot, you know, a universe full of life, all different kinds of life. Therefore, Prabhupada was saying that we'll show this Siddhaloka, Charanaloka, all these Jnanaloka, we'll show these things in our Mayapur temple and display, you know, a universe full of life. So this was Prabhupada's, you know, preaching. He had that realization. So although at that time he'd never probably met any real, you know, so-called scientists when he printed this leaflet, he was quite happy to go into, you know, this very atheistic atmosphere and challenge them. Now I'm going to show you what real science is about. Now that's what the Mayapur temple is all about, and that's what Srila Prabhupada was all about also. So then, as far as the rest of the text goes, again, Prabhupada's making a really bold statement. It sounds incredible. He says, the sufferings of the entire human society can at once be brought under control by the individual practice of bhakti yoga, chanting the holy names of God. And then at the end, again, he says that all these bad qualities in the age of Kali, the only remedial measure is that every man should chant the holy name of God individually and collectively. So it sounds very fundamentalist. All right, you know, all the problems in the world. How many problems are there in the world? How much money is being spent every year on, you know, political parties coming up with different political solutions to the so-called problems? How much is being spent on social welfare? You know, how much is being spent on economic development? I mean, when you really start looking at how many problems there are in the world, it's uncountable. And how much money they're spending on that, literally, you know, trillions upon trillions of dollars are being spent every single year trying to figure out the problems and solve them, give people an easier life. Are we getting anywhere? You know, if you look at the last century, they had the First World War, 1914 to 1918, about 20 million people died. And people were aghast that war could be conducted on a scale like that. It was the first time, you know, where the mechanisms became more important than the manpower. You know, with tanks and bombs and aeroplanes, all these things came in the First World War. And at the end of it, you know, people had never seen killing on that scale. Even Napoleon, when he was on the rampage in Europe from about 1790 to about 1812, he conducted 64 wars in that short period, 20 years. They said he was responsible for about 2 million young men dying because of his military campaigns. He took the whole of Europe. He went as far as Moscow. He actually entered into the Kremlin. I mean, you know, he was ferocious. But, you know, he was a military commander. He was out there on his horse with his troops, getting shot at, getting attacked, and he was in the thick of it. That was how wars were fought in those days, and generally people in the cities were not disturbed. Unless, of course, the troops came in and ransacked the city, but that's another thing. But generally, you know, it was one army against another. You come to the First World War, you know, they're blowing the heck out of all the, you know, non-combatants, bombing cities and, you know, building huge cannons to fire, you know, missiles here and there and everywhere and blasting everybody to smithereens. So, you know, the nature of warfare changed, and as a result, killing on a scale that had never been seen before took place. So at the end of it all, they said, this is the great war. There'd never been a war like this. This is the war to end all wars. So they started a League of Nations. You know, they hope that somehow or another we'll get together and figure out some solution to the problems that led to this horrendous war. 20 years later, they're at it again. And then this time, 50 million people die. Yeah, not 20, but 50 million people died in the Second World War. Same thing. And then again, United Nations. What happens as soon as they form the United Nations, then you get the Korean War and then you get the Vietnam War. The British Empire was being broken up by mini-wars all over the place. And there's never actually been a single year where there hasn't been at least a dozen wars going on all over the planet. You know, in South America, in Africa, in Asia, fighting. That's all there is. Last year I was in Lika, which is in Croatia, and it's in the Balkans. We had the summer camp there. And, you know, in the area where we had the camp, there was a few small villages. And I saw, you know, had some houses were kind of half burnt down. Other ones had big, huge holes, you know, in the facades. Because, you know, 15 to 16 years ago, they were fighting. The Serbs and the Croats and the Bosnians and that whole area. You know, 1989, the Soviet Union collapses. Everybody's in ecstasy. Oh, now we're free. Now all our problems will be solved. Right? We got rid of the oppressors. Now we're all free. And as soon as, what do they do with their freedom? They blow each other up. Yeah, in villages where, you know, the Croats and the Serbs were living together peacefully previously, as soon as that so-called political freedom came, the first thing that they did was declare their independence from each other, and then they became enemies. So people that were formerly living peacefully together in a village started burning each other's houses down. Yeah, first of all, the Croatians burnt down the Serbs' houses, then the Serbs came back and burnt down their houses. The whole area was devastated for about 5 or 6 years. So at any moment, just by some, you know, little political adjustment or some economic adjustment, just like in Greece now, they're having riots. Why? Because the economy's going bad. They may lose the euro or whatever it is. Any slight little, you know, perturbation in human society, immediately people are at each other's throats, they're fighting and killing and, you know, doing whatever they do. So this is, you know, the nature of the material world. It's not a peaceful place. There is no real goodwill. It's all wrangling and maneuvering and, you know, trying to take advantage of each other. And as soon as you perceive that you're going to lose your advantage, then what do? You send in the drones. They don't even go there and fight themselves anymore. They send some unmanned aeroplane to go and blast the heck out of, you know, a few villages in Afghanistan or whatever it is. Why? Because they want to protect their interests. So, you know, Prabhupada's coming in the middle of all of that and saying, just chant Hare Krishna, all your problems will be solved. It really sounds very fundamental. It sounds very simplistic, you know, sentimental. How can that be that you can solve all these problems that for, you know, hundreds of years, actually, if you look at the history of Britain, I saw that there was a series by, what's his name? I can't remember his name. But anyway, there was a series, The History of Britain. And they looked at the history of Britain for 1,000 years. And every single episode was about, well, this came in and this king came in and he fought that one and killed this one and killed that one. And then there was a war here and then the French invaded England and then the English invaded the French. And, you know, every single episode, it was one war after another. That's the history. And it will continue on. There's not going to be any change in the world's activities because there's no change in their mentality. That's the key. Prabhupada knew that you can make all the external arrangements that you like. You can make all the different political parties. You can make all the planning commissions. You can make all the economic forums, whatever else is going on, all the social services. But the problems just keep on getting worse and worse and worse. They, you know, grow at bigger and bigger scale. Why? Because the mentality remains the same. People's hearts remain polluted, you know, with the lower modes of nature, ignorance and passion. And therefore, all these bad qualities, hate, hypocrisy, quarrel, corruption, it's there. If it's there in the individual's heart, it must come out in his actions. Yeah, thinking, feeling, and willing. What you think first, then you become emotional. It comes down to an emotional level and you feel an impulse to do it. And then your action follows. So thinking, feeling, and willing. Because all of their thoughts are misdirected. They have no proper understanding of who they are, why they're here, what the goal in life is, anything higher. Then everybody's just, you know, emerged in this ignorance of thinking that they are the body. And thinking that they're in competition with every other living being. So as long as the mentality remains the same, you cannot change any problem in the world. You can't make any adjustment which will bring about peace and goodwill. It's not possible. So Prabhupada, when he came to the West, he wasn't coming, you know, talking about world peace conferences and yoga conferences and this and that. You'll see in, I think it was about 74, Yogi Bhajan and Swami Chidananda, a couple of others, they came to see Prabhupada. Maybe it was in Berkeley. You might be able to correct me. Berkeley. And they're inviting Prabhupada to come to a world peace conference. Prabhupada said no. Said there'll never be any peace. So he flatly refused to, you know, cooperate. They have some sentiment, you know, let's try and somehow or another through yoga and this and that, you know, bring about some kind of peaceful idea. But Prabhupada said no. Similarly, in 1976, when we were in Mayapur, this lady came, Yoga Shakti Ma. So she came with three followers. And they'd come, she had a little leaflet. On the bottom, there was a reply address, some flat in Calcutta. So she was promoting a World Yoga Peace Conference. And they wanted Prabhupada to come and speak. So Prabhupada said, no. He said, it's like this. He said, if you go in a stool house and wave some incense, will it make it a better place to live? You do your business and get out. She became completely shocked. Prabhupada had mentioned a stool house. They were there in this bubble of, you know, bliss. Oh, we'll all be lovey-dovey and peace and goodwill and happiness through our peace conference. Prabhupada told her, look, this place is a stool house. Do your business. Get out. That's it. So they immediately stopped. They became very insulted. One of the men that was with her, he became so insulted, he started literally shaking. And he couldn't talk. And they all got up and walked out and went back to Calcutta. Prabhupada laughed. As soon as they walked out, he just laughed. And he said, for all their yoga shakti, he said, they have one small flat in Calcutta. He said, we have no such shakti, and we are spreading all over the world. So he wasn't interested in these kind of sentimental programs, or even, you know, any other kind of program that doesn't change the heart of the living being. If you want to actually bring peace and goodwill in human society, it can only be done on the basis of Chaito Dharpa Namarjanam. Yeah, chanting the holy names as a practical effect in purifying the heart of the individual. And therefore he's saying that all the problems of the entire human society can at once be solved by the individual practice of chanting the holy names of God. Because it actually transforms the state of consciousness of a person. As soon as his consciousness is transformed, that means your actions will automatically follow. As you think, so you do. Thinking, feeling, and willing. So therefore, Prabhupada had a solution, a real solution, by getting to the heart of the problems. All the problems. It doesn't matter what the problems are. They come out in different ways. But the real problem is ignorance. The real problem is a lack of understanding of the nature of the self. And therefore people, you know, go through repeating the same behavior and getting the same results again and again and again. I saw the other day some little saying that a symptom of madness is thinking that you can do the same actions again and again, but get a different result. That's madness. If you want to actually get a different result, you have to change your behavior. If you want to change your behavior, you have to change your mind. And that's what chanting does. So therefore, the holy name, chanting the holy name, and as Prabhupada says, it can be done in any community according to what name you're familiar with. Like with the Muslims, they have the 1,000 names of Allah. I remember seeing a book in Indonesia, 100 or 1,000 names of Allah. So in that way, if people just chant the names of God, this is the process in Kali Yuga for counteracting all the bad qualities and bringing people to a state of peace and goodwill. When a person's genuinely in touch with Krishna, automatically he becomes peaceful. automatically develops, you know, goodwill towards all other persons, all other living entities, not just human beings either. All living beings. Prabhupada was always insistent, if you want to talk about doing good to others, then talk about the animals and the birds and everything else as well. They're also living beings. Nowadays, it's estimated that they're killing about 48 billion land animals every single year. 48 billion, you can't even compute it. How many, you know, land animals are getting slaughtered? And that's not the fishes either. You can't even begin to estimate the amount of fish that's being done. And there's 42 million abortions every single year around the planet. People have become so depraved that they, you know, even their own children, they're flushing out, you know. So the world is in a mess. And there's not going to be any solution anytime soon. People have to take up the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. This is the only practical way that you can purify the heart, and then your actions will automatically follow. So that was Prabhupada. He was very clear about what he was doing when he, you know, was coming to the West. He had a particular mission, but he had the practical realization, not just talking philosophy, but he himself was situated on that platform. Therefore, he signed all of his letters, "Your ever well-wisher." Your ever well-wisher. Always, Prabhupada was emanating this good wishes to others. Yeah? Never working on a platform of false ego or, you know, self-interest, but entirely for the interests of others. So this is only possible on the transcendental platform. It's only possible on the platform of Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada, of course, was the exemplar of that. Yeah. The broadness of his, you know, actions, just traveling all over the world constantly at, you know, incredible cost to himself. I mean, now we're just getting, how old are you, Yadavara Prabhu? How old is your body? How old? 68. So you're 2 years younger than when Prabhupada started. I'm not going to ask Malati. We're not supposed to ask them. But anyway, she doesn't mind. How old are you? 68. So we're getting up to the age, you know, that Prabhupada was when he first began. And somebody told me about a meeting of the American Academy of Religions. There was some professor there, some of our devotees were there. This was some years back. And this professor got up and he said, actually, he said, "You Hare Krishna devotees," I'm paraphrasing, this is not exactly it, but "you Hare Krishna devotees, you actually don't appreciate your spiritual master and what he did for you." And the devotees are thinking, us? You know, we're the ones that have taken up what he's asked us to do. You're a professor. How can you say that we're not appreciating? But then he explained, he said, "And you won't appreciate until you're 70 years old. Then you'll understand what he did." So, from a practical point of view, when you get old, so many things start going wrong. Yeah. When you're young, you're indestructible, you think. You know, you've got that energy. Anything goes wrong, you can bounce back and, you know, immediately your body repairs itself. But when you get old, and mostly, we were just talking this morning, mostly life is all about going downhill. There's not very much going up. You know, from about 15 to 35, you've got your youthful period. That's it. And then after that, you know, it's all struggle. Actually, it's always struggle. You just have an illusion when you're young that you're not struggling, but you really are. Yeah, my most difficult period of life was when I was a teenager. It was hellish, I can say that, you know, being born and brought up in Scunthorpe, or as Rameshwara used to call it, Scumthorpe. So, you know, tough life. But living in the material world is tough. And as long as we have a material body, it's tough. Yeah, birth, death, disease, and old age. So if we really want to bring, you know, or get a solution to all the problems, we have to chant. That's the point. That's the only effective remedy for curing all the problems in life. So, you know, when people challenge you, you know, if you're out in Sankirtan and they challenge you, why are you just chanting Hare Krishna? Why don't you do something practical? You can explain to them, this is the only practical thing that can be done if you really want a solution to the problems of human society. Okay, so I'm going to finish at this point. Does anybody have any comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu.